Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Manu Swarth, and I'm here today with Renate Dalle. Together, we are the editors-in-chief of the Cambridge International Law Journal, and we're delighted to welcome you today to our annual lecture, which is a joint event held together with the Lauterbach Center for International Law. We are very grateful to have Professor Sarifa Sekhalala here today, and we look forward to her upcoming remarks on a very topical matter indeed. I also want to extend our thanks to Professor Henning Korser-Ruzekahn for chairing the event today, and more generally to the Lauterbach Center, who have been instrumental and continuously supported us in our annual lecture for the past couple of years. For those of you who don't know what the Cambridge International Law Journal is, I'm going to give over to my co-editor, Renatus, to tell you a little bit more about that.
Thank you, Manu. So, whilst many of you here are familiar with the International Law Journal, I'll just say a brief word. So, the Cambridge International Law Journal succeeded the Cambridge Journal of International and Comparative Law, which was established in 2011 by postgraduate students at the University of Cambridge. The Cambridge International Law Journal is a double-blind peer-reviewed journal with a broad focus on international law. The journal provides a platform for young and well-established academics to publish outstanding research on cutting-edge, highly topical international law issues alongside and in dialogue with each other. The journal is published by Edward Elgar Publishing in form of two issues per year. On this note, we are delighted to announce that some of Professor Sekhalala's remarks today will be published in the form of an article in the upcoming issue of the journal, specifically volume 14.1, in June 2025, so next year. Many thanks again to Professor Sekhalala for your upcoming lecture and contribution to the journal. Thank you so much.
Right. I think you can hear and see me, so I didn't need to. Should I get up in terms of the microphone so people can hear me online? Yeah, is that
okay? Anyway, so okay.
Right. Okay, so thank you, everyone. Thank you for the introduction on the Cambridge International Law Journal. As you have said, this is the joint sort of supported lecture on global health law by the Lauterbach Center and the journal, Cambridge Journal for International Law. And we are all very happy to have Professor Sarifa Sekhalala here with us. My name is Henning Korser-Ruzekahn. I'm a professor here at the law faculty, mainly doing IP, and that is has a significant interface with international health law. So I'm very sort of curious and look forward to hear from you, Professor Sekhalala. Just to perhaps mention that Professor Sekhalala from the University of Warwick heads the Center for Global Health Law at that university. She has been doing lots of interdisciplinary work in the context of human rights, health, and as I just heard, is engaged in a pretty long project funded by the Wellcome Trust on international health law and post-crisis scenario. So without further ado, we welcome you to hear from you about In the Shadow of Trade, Critique of Global Health Law. Professor Sekhalala, the floor is yours. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here. I was supposed to give this last year and I got COVID. So it was kind of an interesting irony. So thank you for inviting me, to Ms. Rabi, for extending the invitation, for the Cambridge Journal of International Law, for asking me to give this joint lecture. I'm really kind of very pleased to be here. So this work is made possible by a grant from the Wellcome Trust Discovery Awards. It's called After the End, Interdisciplinary Approaches to Lived Experiences in the Aftermath of Crisis. And so we look at diseases, drugs, and disasters. And as part of this work, I lead the legal work package that thinks about the ways in which law in some ways marks the beginning and ends of crisis in various ways. And as part of this work, I'm thinking a lot about how we can repair global health systems. So, yeah. So the lecture will take the form of a couple of sections. So firstly, I will briefly take you through what happened during COVID, what were the failures from a global health law position, what were the limitations of the discipline itself in responding, and then try and think about how we're negotiating new treaties in some cases and trying to rethink old treaties in other cases, and what I think are the fundamental flaws with that approach. And lastly, I'll speak a bit about reparations. So in one of the things that for me is, has been an enduring question, so if you're a global health lawyer, the crisis was really weird, but also kind of, so suddenly you were very busy, but you thought, but we've always been doing this stuff. We've always been saying there's no access to medicines. And so one of the things for me that's been quite enduring about this and other global health crisis is that question around how we can ensure that people have access to medicines, but also as we saw to things like supply chains in the midst of crisis. And it really is kind of a fundamental question about justice, as I think we will see. And one of the arguments that I make in this broader piece of work is that we need to kind of look less at structural problems, or let's try and think about how we can find a program on access to medicines for this crisis, and a longer period to kind of go back and think about why structurally a system is constructed in this way. And that's made me think a lot about kind of colonial health and how it fits in with the current global health system. So if you look at TRIPS, one of the arguments that I'd like to make, so TRIPS, for those of you, so like, I don't know how many of you are trade lawyers. So TRIPS, which are the rules that govern intellectual property, are sustained by a mechanism that really promotes global justice. And this is largely allowing private corporations from the north to the ability to set high prices, and this excludes many countries from the global south. So there have been many attempts to try and change this, but these haven't been particularly successful. And so we've kind of been really thinking through why these attempts were not successful. So for me, this is because global health law as a regime is preoccupied with two things. So the first is that it tries to prevent the spread of infectious disease across borders. So you try and ensure disease either doesn't spread, or that if it does spread, you can manage the spread. The second is a real particular emphasis on ensuring that like while a crisis is happening, you have trade still being able to continue. And so for me, trying to think about that, that's kind of where the tension comes in, because you're on the one hand trying to prevent crisis, but on the other hand, also trying to ensure that at all times, trade is continuing to happen. And so for me, we then must think about a system of repair that tries to kind of make material differences. And a bit of this work in the lecture will be trying to think about how that might look like. So if you lived in the UK or North America, the crisis was very odd, because it was kind of, like in retrospect now, it was very low stakes. Like everybody was running around for loo roll, and there were attempts that we might all die, but we're not quite sure whether we all die, because there was no cooking. And so everybody started making it in their kitchens. And so there was like this really wild sense of a crisis happening, but very slow, but also very peculiar. But actually, I think this mask kind of the global injustices. So while we're struggling to get people here, what happened is our governments were then trying to grab other people's people on the tarmac everywhere. And so you had this global health injustices play out. And we also see that it then, in some ways, also amplified ideas about the closures, you close a border too. So if you remember when South Africa sank the variant, because the border not only to them, but collectively to all the entire African nations, because they were considered porous, despite the fact that we had it. So on the one hand, it was kind of a very domestic crisis. But on the other hand, I think at every step of the way, it was illustrating much broader global injustices. And perhaps the most serious one was around access to vaccines. We saw at the time that countries in the global south had serious problems trying to get the amount of vaccine that they needed, while we were hoarding huge amounts of vaccines that we didn't need. And so this kind of felt very predictable when you dealt with the health law as a discipline, but again, kind of felt that there was something inherent with the health law system that allowed this to imagine. So this slide is always like, do you get global health law or all international lawyers kind of pretend to fragment the discipline even further? So global health law has been defined as a study and practice of international law that shapes norms and processes and institutions. And kind of underlying that is the highest attainable standard of risk and mental health. So it has the major treaty, especially for crisis, is the IHR. So the IHR, this is the International Health Regulations of 2005. And these were designed in order to coordinate health crises, including disease outbreaks. And a fundamental part of that is ensuring of early notification systems and containment so that diseases do not cross borders. And indeed, one of the things that kind of amplifies from just being a domestic crisis to an international crisis under the IHR is that the disease has spread through borders. It's now kind of ceased to be contained in that way. However, as I said before, it also has another purpose. So one of the trade-offs at the time of signing the IHR was to kind of convince people who might have been skeptical about diseases spreading across borders that actually you needed this in order for international trade to continue. And so normatively, you seem to have these two things around trade intersecting and therefore kind of reinforcing kind of IHR provisions around the idea that you need to kind of contain disease in this way. And so the IHR is an interesting document because when you look at the treaty itself, the bulk of it is actually dealing with things like supply chains, it's dealing with trips. It's so like it says very little about disease itself, although underlying is kind of this idea that you want to prevent disease. And another thing that's specific about the IHR is that when Article 57 of the IHR, it makes it very clear that states need to comply with their obligations in other treaties. And this was kind of very, like, was fought for at the time in order to ensure that trade obligations were being complied with the states by at all times. And so they are kind of general provisions in there, and they mention trade specifically in order to ensure that countries, even when they're fighting a crisis, are still complying with their trade obligations. The other thing that's interesting about the IHR is that when people in global health mention it, they're really proud of the fact that it's a binding treaty, but it has very little enforcement powers when you compare it to other treaties in international law. And so it has these 196 parties, they've all signed up, but actually you can't really enforce very much. It has some sort of mediation, it's never been used before. So there's kind of a lot of vagueness around how you enforce it. And so I think that that's always kind of an interesting thing that actually became kind of very present in the last So the second thing that you might have in order to try and think about crises is this WHO review. So after every crisis, the WHO has a post-crisis review. And I found them interesting because they, like, really, a WHO leadership, what did you do wrong? And there's kind of very little said about anything structural in these reviews. And so the way in which the WHO diagnoses life after crisis is always around kind of, could governance have been better? Could we have been better prepared? But nothing around the structural underlying determinants of why the crisis happened. So for me, I think that that's also something that's really quite interesting to think about this global health law system, that the things that sustain it in order to diagnose what's wrong with it are really incapable of doing what we want it to do, especially if you, like me, think that there is a longer arc around some of the problems. So in the wake of the last pandemic, which was the COVID-19 pandemic, the WHO launched two simultaneous processes. One was to try and get a new treaty, so the pandemic treaty accord I don't know, now it's just a pandemic thing because we failed to even agree on a phone. And then it also tried to get the IHR revised. So the IHR was supposed to be revised in order to make them much clearer and better in order to serve. So when Surabhi asked me to have this talk, I thought at that time, because there was all this talk, this was going to be the fastest treaty we'd ever say. It was like time was urgent. It was, we really had to make our minds up. So for those of you who follow international law, many years later, we still have no treaty. There are signs that we might have it next year, but we are not optimistic about whether this will happen. And I kind of argue in other pieces that actually that idea of time and making this timely thing was like really odd for countries who had crisis all the time, because they kind of just thought, we have crisis all the time. So this idea that it's now very urgent, and therefore in 9 months, we must make our minds up, is really peculiar, because like there's nothing urgent here. We've kind of seen all of this before. The IHR, though, has agreed to some revisions, and on the 1st of June 2024, the World Health Assembly, through a resolution, adopted a package of amendments that will come in force in a year's time. It might be interesting if the USA drops, because then I do not know what will happen. We might have 195 countries, who knows? But I think that for me, one of the things that has been interesting around these reforms was kind of their focus on this notion of equity without ever really naming it. So like equity is not, like we're not quite sure what it is. We're not quite sure what it is. So like it's this amorphous recent thing. And so if you see it in the pandemic treaty, like it keeps moving. So it's now a goal. It's like a principle, something that we should think about. It started off as kind of something much more precise, and it gets kind of subsequently weaker. The IHR as well has in Article 3.1 said, well, again, there's an emphasis on solidarity and equity, so we are all in this together. And again, it includes this in its guiding principles. So, and it has this vague idea that wealthier nations will kind of give some sort of resource, how many is not known, when not known, but that we will pitch in when the time comes and we'll solve our crisis. So it's clear for me that actually these underlying tensions that you have in global health law and trade are still kind of influencing all these new treaty forms. And that's why we can't get to where we want to. We can't agree on whether it's a crisis or not, because people come in with very different viewpoints. We can't agree on things like technology access, because countries have very different viewpoints. We can't agree on whether this is a crisis or not. So like, again, because countries have very different viewpoints. And what I want to argue is that it's because we haven't gone far enough in trying to think about global health as a discipline. So the global, global health for me comes from a longer tradition of coloniality, which involved extraction and medicine being located in a very particular place. So medicine was considered both modern, but was also considered really essential in order to extract. So you had global health medicine in places so that you could continue to use these as extractive sites. And this kind of remains a present even today. So when you think about the regulation of global medicine, part of it was to try and think, who is a doctor? What is a medicine? And not at a stroke of a legislative pen, took out lots of things that many societies had considered medicine and created kind of a de facto standard of modern day medicine, modern day vaccines, modern day preventative cures. And I think that that's kind of worth exploring. And I think that they are three particular things that I want to look at in kind of this narrative arc. The first is to think about pharmaceutical production. So people like Neil and others have traced pharmaceutical production in colonial times, and actually pharmaceutical production in colonial time was way more distributed globally than it is at the moment. And this went in the post-colonial era because then you didn't need that much, like the extraction that it had changed, the nature of that extraction had changed. And so then pharmaceutical industries were now based in the global north, or constantly based in the global south. So this in effect means that places, so some sites in the global south, so Africa, become places for thinking, studying, creating pandemics, but they're not places for making vaccines. So they become sites of inquiry, but not sites of really hard solutions. There are some exceptions. So we have India and Thailand solutions because they create high volumes of generic medicine. But some scholars of medicine, like Sarah Hodges, argue that actually, even with that, they become places of suspicion. So their medicines are not quite good enough. They're good medicines. We can use them in a crisis, but they're not quite good enough. And that, for me, is part of a longer colonial story. The second thing where we kind of really have to think about colonialism really attentively in global health law is around the racialization of border and border investment. So global health law as a discipline emerges from sanitary conferences that were supposed to protect Europe against disease from the outside world. So between 1851 and 1938, you have these 14 sanitary conferences. And a big part of this is supposed to be exclusion of the other. And as I said before, in Omicron, in country sequencing and excluded, we see kind of this particular aspect that's still today in the ways in which we kind of structured global health as a system. The third thing is the work on lawmaking. So where does global health law as a discipline come from? How does it work and how is it constructed? And like really interesting work that we have seen more recently around decolonial health scholars, decolonial international law scholars, pointing out the fact that international law is situated in very much in the global north. It tells a particular story of what law should look like, and global health law here is no different. And then, so what I wanted to draw attention to is then the TRIPS agreement in particular as kind of a tool that locates both coloniality and capitalism. So I found Amma Kavani's work interesting about this because it has that historical arc that really thinks about colonialism, racism, inequality, and how they become embedded in the international intellectual property law project. Because countries in the global south have been forced to apply rules that are bad for their health outcomes in order to have some trade advantages. So the result is an IP regime that ensures that you have medicines that are unaffordable for the global majority for most of the time. The second thing that I wanted to make a link to is around genetic resources as property. One of the things that really comes clear in a crisis is why it's so important to know very quickly that you have the disease somewhere, is that at that point you need samples from that country in order to sequence both to understand how it's spreading, but also in order if you don't have a vaccine to make one. And the sequencing from China in the last pandemic was super important, but also for the Omicron variant, because then pharmaceutical companies changed the ways in which they make their drugs in order to try and find a vaccine that's more efficient. And one of the things that has happened under an intellectual property regime has been this idea that genetic resources such as samples have been turned into a form of property. So Turner and Rook in their work also kind of really linked this to part of a colonial project, which kind of went away and kind of in fact stole plants, stole samples from different places and brought them back to the global north. And this is kind of seems part of this larger situation. Countries in effect cede what is genetic property that belongs to them as a sovereign resource and give it to the global community. And this would be fine if health was the public good and we're all in this together. But if all you get is border closures, you have no medicines, then it kind of seems very difficult. And so as we saw in the last the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw that intellectual property itself was critical to our drug shortages. And any of the new things that we saw, any of the legal interventions that we saw that work, like compulsory licensing, were not very quick because it was MNRA, which was new. We didn't know how to reverse engineer it fast enough, and therefore you could use any of the legal processes that we had in order to make these vaccines available. And so this goes to the last part of my presentation where I try to think, so if the system is broken, if I can make this case that in fact we're just not looking far enough in order to think about the solution, it made me think, how can you repair it? And so I was trying to think about kind of reparations, which come from the word repair, as a process of remedying damage. And there's a lot of work on reparations, especially in post-conflict settings. There's increasing calls for reparations on slavery in Jamaica, in the USA. And The Lancet in 2019 actually recognized kind of the impact, enduring impact on health, and organized a panel on reparations and restorative justice. However, a lot of the work on reparations and even The Lancet's work, which was actually very good, is centered on outcomes for descendants of slavery, so people in North America who still have these impacts. And so I was trying to think, so if you wanted to make it broader, so if you wanted to have this broader question of reparations, how would it look like? But it led me to kind of thinking there are potential problems with an approach like that, because I had to think kind of what's the violation, where does it begin and where does it end? So in some ways, slavery, although again, large arc, it's still kind of one particular process. I had to think, which groups are you benefiting? Because again, the global south of the global majority is quite vast. They have different interests. And then I had to seriously say, is it too large a group in order to benefit from reparations? So like if it's a global majority, does it become kind of too big a group? So in the piece I'm hoping to write, which I now am firmly committed to writing, which I wasn't before this lecture, I rely on Olufumi Taiwo's work on reconsidering reparations and how he thinks about kind of ideas of creating a just future as opposed to merely compensation for past wrongs. And how this involves transforming societal structures to address systemic inequalities by colonialism and by slavery. And I think one of the things that I'm really interested in doing in using his work is also taking the role of agency seriously. So in his work against decolonization, where he's kind of against this idea that, yeah, like it's like we kind of throw everything out and just try to say, like, what do the people want, reparations want? And so I'm interested in using it in three ways. So the first is kind of thinking about collectiveness and really thinking about the collective nature of rights to health, which are not the same as individual rights because they're contingent on other people's rights. And for me, this is important, again, when I look at the way in which a lot of the global majority looks at the notion of collective as opposed to individualistic rights. The second thing that I'm interested in is this idea of transformation. And so thinking about it as moving beyond historic injustices that are just around compensation to transforming the system, the global health system that we have. So it's kind of future-oriented, thinking about systematic change. And then the third is kind of taking agency seriously and kind of using that as thinking about countries in the global south reclaiming spaces in order to articulate their demands on a global health system. And this for me involves a move away from It involves moving away from like the idea of charity, which is the way in which we're defining equity now, which is the idea that rich countries will at some point, maybe perhaps give poor countries some money when a crisis comes. And thinking about it less as kind of an individual system where after every crisis we ascribe harm to really reimagining structure changes. So what does that involve? So I started off, so I have an amazing PhD student, Shadra Lake, started off with kind of like, what's the most radical thing that we can do? It's like, we could tear the system down, have a new form of treaties, not buy, like, ensure that everything is binding in our world. So like, I started off kind of from the most radical thing. We picked one area, I started off with the most radical things that we could do. So like our wish list of things that we imagine kind of a global health law system to do. So that treaty would imagine equity, not just as a principle, it would reflect resources, it would be precise about the calculation of those resources, it would establish a pandemic fund, people would have to pay into it. So like that was my like Christmas wish list. So I started off with my Christmas wish list. But then, okay, beyond my utopian ideal, I then thought, are there other ways in which we could think about kind of some form of reparations? And so I am picking those examples of reparatory practice. So part of it, the idea is thinking about the Africa group and their strategies within these negotiations, the things that they have been fighting for. And one of them has been the idea that they wanted a new access and benefit sharing system. And this access and benefit sharing system was supposed to ensure that if they then give vaccines to us, if they give samples, that they got something in return. So that they would trade their sovereign rights in exchange for some sort of capacity building. And in particular, they focused very much on vaccine manufacturing in Africa with very clear precise targets of what those would look like. The second thing was they talked a lot about kind of technological transfer that would facilitate that, and then again had very clear ideas of what the technological transfer would look like, what obligations on pharmaceutical companies would be like. And then the third example was thinking about kind of the South-South cooperation where countries from the South, again, are helping each other in order to kind of reimagine a different system. Here I give the Health Development Partnership for Africa and the Caribbean as an example that is, again, sponsored by the leaders of Barbados, Guyana, and Rwanda to foster health infrastructure between Africa and the Caribbean. And again, trying very much to think about vaccine manufacturing and strategies for ensuring that vaccine manufacturing is both present, but it's also stable over time within the region. So I kind of think, again, I kind of started off with like, it's too big a group. It's like, I have all of these problems with reparations. And I still think that even with that, I might still have some of these problems. So again, we still have a TRIP system that's been left intact. And actually from the negotiations, it shows no sign that that system will change. There's fear of a precedent that this is successful, it's going to have a massive impact on pharmaceutical companies in the North. And so there is a danger that actually this might work out in the way in which I want it to work. And also I kind of worry that a lot of the systems that I'm thinking about are now not medically constituted. I've become a really big lawyer. So I started off as an international lawyer, I'm to global health, and now I kind of am becoming a policymaker. So I think that that's a concern at the end of my book. And so I kind of end up with, where do we go from here? I think there are quite a few limitations, but if I take seriously the idea that reparations is not a privilege, but also in the idea that human rights have never, like rights of any sort have never been easy. So like, and as we see, actually we can gain them only to lose them. So the struggle for rights is not an easy one. So for me, in fact, this becomes a future world-making project at the moment. And so we must kind of center people's resistance and movements as articulators and developers of the language of rights. And so reparations then becomes a future project of lawmaking. And that could be a totally new system, if I got my way of utopia. But if we don't, we might have these very small piecemeal efforts that still make some changes to the system. So that's it.